appreciate the messages on these last few books here. Brother Taylor, on your particular topic with Proverbs, have you ever particularly focused in on chapter 30, verse 15, where it said greed has two daughters? Proverbs 30, 15. Yeah, greed has two daughters. Give me, in the modern version. Have you ever studied that particularly in depth?
I have studied that book pretty thoroughly in the past, but that wasn't the focus of this particular study. Here we were really, the purview of this study was to focus on the structure of the book, trying to look at it in general terms rather than dealing with individual passages.
I don't know if you have it. That particular verse has always intrigued me since I first found it, basically the modern version. The King James is a little more difficult for me to understand. Once we got to the modern version, it made it a little easier. I just didn't know if you had anything particular to add to that. Brother Butler, your son waited on the table several months back and mentioned, Royce did, he mentioned a lesson that you preached a long time ago in a book you read about Psalms 23. I don't know if you remember what sermon he may have been speaking of, but it's really some good information in it. Does that strike you?
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
The information that I had used to get it on it came from an article that actually appeared in the Reader's Digest probably 30 or so years ago. A shepherd looks at the psalm, and told an interview that was done with a shepherd out in the northwest of Nevada, somewhere out there. And he explained that many of the ideas and the things that the psalmist or the shepherd experienced related to his knowledge of sheep and the relationship that existed between the sheep and the shepherd. It would gain insight then in our relationship with God.
Do you by chance remember the name? It was really, the points he made referred back to your sermon about a book. Do you remember the name of the book by any chance?
Well, that was an article. There is a book, however, and I don't have it with me. It's called The Shepherd Looks at the Psalm, but I can't remember the author. Yes. In fact, that will be in the reference list for this it's a very, very good book. However, it is a different one. I had not seen that when I preached that sermon earlier. Anyway, it still is a shepherd working psalm.
Well, this is probably for Glenn Taylor and Wayne. Is there an agreement that the three books was probably written in the following sequence? The Song of Solomon was early in Solomon's writings, Proverbs probably later than Ecclesiastes is last. Is that, do y'all pretty much tend to agree with that, or am I mistaken on that one?
I don't think I could.
I don't know. In my studies, that's what was suggested. In fact, some even saw a design in that, showed a different focus on different things in life. But that's my understanding.
There are some scholars who believe that the book of Proverbs was really intended as Solomon's instruction to Rehoboam. Of course, the tragedy of that whole thing is, if he wrote that specifically for Rehoboam, then both he and Rehoboam didn't profit much from it, because in view of all that Solomon said about women, and then all of these entanglements that he got involved in, and then all he said about a son becoming wise, and Rehoboam turned out to be
I had a brother in one of the gospel preachers in a different state contacted me quite a while back, and he was disturbed because one of the local teachers taught that Solomon was lost because of the sequence of the books having sown Solomon been last, thinking he died with that, with a mindset that was not pleasing to God. But when I began to do a little study on that, I found probably the Song of Solomon, Proverbs, and the Ecclesiastes gave the center of his life, as Brother Wayne just mentioned, and that he phased out with a very positive outlook on life regardless of what was transpired. And I have no reason to believe that Solomon himself obviously was lost. But one more question for Brother Ray. One had a brother last week ask me about that, and I had not heard that. So I thought I'd make it.
Just because of the reference to the sacrifices Job made, it must have come from a patriarchal age. And if the Pentateuch was written by later writers, then it was not contemporaneous. Job would have to be one of the early writers.
Okay, Doug Edwards.
When you referred to Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 5 and said that you didn't have time to talk about it, would you just go ahead and elaborate on that passage?
Example, then you can't possibly train a child. But that there is a belief that
that that passage would be better translated, train up the child according to his way, which means that a parent has to be extremely wise, knowing that children are different. No two of them are exactly alike. What will work in training one child won't necessarily work in training the other. And then it says, when he's old, he'll not depart from it. It troubles me that a lot of brethren think that that is just absolutely certain to happen, that if you train a child exactly right, there's no way that child can ever go wrong. That, my friends, is the impossibility of apostasy. It is just as repugnant when Christians teach it as it is when our religious neighbors teach it. The Bible teaches no such doctrine. And if that is in fact what that passage taught, then it would be an absolute guarantee that if the child ever learns the truth, there's no way that child could ever violate it or go away from it. The Bible doesn't teach that. Children, like anybody else, have choices to make, and we've heard that discussed here today.
Okay, thank you. Smith, please.
In Henry Morse's book on the book of Job, he presents the idea that the rabbis taught that Job was authored by Moses. Did you encounter that at all, Ray? Any comment about that? Likely.
Why did they say that?
Henry Morse, he was quoting.
Why did they say that? Did he say why did they say that?
No. He just said that the rabbi said that.
Yeah, the information I had was from higher critics after tendency quitting with the restoration or captivity. But it doesn't make sense because the kind of suffering that Job was undergoing was not from the same motives as Israel suffered. Plus, the higher critics also always talk about the priestly source, and the priestly source, according to them, was so jealous of the priestly role that they would never have written a book that had a father of the family offering sacrifices. It would always be a priest.
Was Job an Edomite? In one of the books we were looking at the other day, talking about Edom, Uz is used in a synonymous parallelism with Edom. And, sometimes it's the same word can be used in different geographical locations.
Alan Bonifay.
Raymond, have you ever read Henry Morris's little book on Job? He makes an interesting statement about the last chapter there where Job receives twice as much as he had before, except for the fact that he doesn't receive twice as many children. And he says it's one of those incidental proofs of the eternity of the spirit, because he still had 10 children, they just weren't alive. So he only got 10 more. It's pretty interesting. Wayne, in Ecclesiastes 3:21, the spirit of the animal goeth downward. You're not responsible for every verse in this book, but I just wanted to get a comment about that.
Seems like he's asking a question there, He said, who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? He was putting it in kind of an indefinite way there. But then later, when he writes about he returns to the dust, the Spirit goes to God and gave it. Well, he's very definite about it there.
We ordinarily teach an animal as an animal. So, what Doug said about these being such short, pithy statements, that the shorter and sharper the statement, the more side things that are not covered by it. So it ends up being a general rule or a rule of thumb, or a wise saying. Doesn't Proverbs chapter 26 help to illustrate that? And maybe you have a comment about those two verses where it says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. And the next verse says, answer a fool according to his folly, blessed to be wise in his own eyes. It looks like both of those have to be general rules to me.
Yeah, Jimmy Cutter and I were talking about that during the break. It would sound on the face of it as though it were a contradiction, but the fact of it is that those principles would apply in different situations. And one of the problems you have with Proverbs from chapter 10 through chapter 25 is that it's mostly two-liners, and what goes in one verse is not related to what goes before or what comes after. You've got two sentences that deal with an issue, and then go on to something else. And since context is so crucial in understanding written text, that's what makes it difficult to understand some of these proverbs, that you don't have a context to deal with. You're just dealing with the two statements standing there alone. I don't want anybody to get the impression that I think parents can absolve their responsibility as far as training children is concerned. I think that passage still teaches that parents must train their children, but I think also that the children are going to have choices to make when they get old. They're going to have to decide if they will forsake the instructions of their mother. You know, that's also counsel from the book of Proverbs. And so I think parents have the obligation to do the best job they can, but I don't think there's a promise in Scripture that even if you've done the best job, I know a lot of very godly parents that I'm convinced did an excellent job of training their children, but the children didn't turn out the way the parents wanted them to. And we shouldn't blame ourselves for that. If we've done a good job, the best hope that our children will turn out right is that we do our job and that we tailor our teaching to the individual needs of the individual children. Jimmy mentioned in earlier question and answer session the practice of reading the book of Proverbs. There are 31 chapters, and that lends itself to a chapter a day. I first learned about that practice from Bruce Caskey when I was holding a meeting at Garland a